You hear about, and you often hear on this station, WFMT in Chicago, the Civic Orchestra of Chicago, the Professional Training Orchestra of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, the Music Now series, the new music series of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, the West Eastern Divan of Daniel Barenboim, his Arab-Israeli Youth Orchestra, the Lucerne Festival Academy of Pierre Boulez, the conductor emeritus of the CSO, who is active in so many different fields, the DePaul Symphony Orchestra, Contempo, the contemporary chamber players of the University of Chicago, and I'm sure I've left out a lot of other places, but when you hear about and hear these organizations and the wonderful work that they do, you very rarely hear about, and you almost never hear from, a man who is intimately involved in making these groups happen, preparing them, and in many cases, leading them. And we've decided to trap the reticent Cliff Colnutt in the studio today, both as a means of previewing the annual Downtown Orchestra Hall concert of the DePaul Symphony Orchestra, Wednesday, May 30th, but also to talk with this remarkable man who, in addition to all the things I've just mentioned, also spends a lot of time teaching at DePaul University School of Music and doing orchestral programs there, and has a very busy business making recorded music for the commercial world. And I don't know when Cliff sleeps, but he always seems ready and rested. So I just want to share some time now with a great colleague and a great friend, Cliff Colnutt. How do you describe yourself, Cliff?
I would say that I have a tremendously wide range of interests on purpose. I've never really tried to zero in on one specific narrowly circumscribed skill set. I enjoy the challenges of widely ranging musical experiences every day, and so I purposely try to sustain a lot of diversity in my career.
That's a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful way of expressing it. I'm going to steal that from you. I explain to people often when they say, you're interested in a lot of different things, I say, I would get bored easily. Mm-hmm. But yours is a much more positive way. But it's very important, too, to emphasize that you not only have this wide range of interests and have developed this wide range of skill sets, if we can think spatially for a moment, horizontally, that is, across many different areas, but I would say also vertically, because you can lead a group, you can work as an assistant to a great maestro, you can act as an intermediary, you are also a coach to many people. In fact, one of your conducting students was just a finalist in the Bamberg Mahler Young Conductors competition in Germany, which is the major competition of its kind in the world, and to be one of 14 finalists out of hundreds of applicants and thousands of potential people is really something. And you work in making your own music and helping others to make music. So there's this vertical and horizontal set of interests and range. How did it start out? Were you a piano key picker, a guitar picker, a banger on cans as a child? Or what was the initial musical connection for you?
It was a fairly archetypal early beginning in the sense that when I was in the public schools, music education in America was a vital and vibrant part of the curriculum. And so there were well-funded and politically and spiritually supported art activities in the public schools everywhere in the area in Ohio where I grew up.
And where did you grow up?
In Youngstown, Ohio. Mm-hmm. And so I just followed the fairly traditional course of in fifth and sixth grade playing some wind instruments, recorders, et cetera, and then in junior high school going into the clarinet and the saxophone, and then in high school changing from the saxophone to the bassoon, and then becoming interested in jazz in high school, and then I played trombone, trumpet, saxophone, in addition to the bassoon. And then around my freshman or sophomore year in high school, decided that music would be my ultimate career. And then I started to diversify into arranging and into theory and into coaching and conducting for the orchestra conductor when he was not available. And so all the seeds for my current diversity of interests were set or planted in the early years of high school.
It sounds as if a common theme, I don't want to mix too many metaphors, I don't want to say a common thread among seeds, but a common theme or a common aspect of these various seeds and what has grown from them is an interest in analyzing and solving problems, whether those are theoretical problems of notes on a page or execution problems of how to make those notes come alive and work.
Mm-hmm. No, that's an absolutely wonderful perception. And I would say that in the early days of my career, right after I got out of music school and college, there was an imbalance in the way I would look at music or the various musical activities, and it would often be heavily Apollonian, heavily tending towards the intellectual kind of deconstruction of the music, and things were viewed more as science than art, and I don't consider that, as I look back on it, a particularly good thing, but it was nevertheless true for 5 to 10 years. And then I would say, in large part due to Daniel Barenboim, I began to more healthily balance the Dionysian and the Apollonian, mm-hmm. and now I feel much more comfortable about my ability to take Derive de and be able to deconstruct that for Mr. Boulez, and at the same time be able to do Tchaik Pathétique or Bruckner 6 with a real sense of line and passion and fire, and as Daniel Barenboim refers to it, stomach.
Mm-hmm. And it's an important point that just as for a period we thought of people who were involved with quote-unquote new music as being specialists, we neglected the fact that a conductor, a composer, a musician should be able to look at, he or she has to find his or her own balance, but should be able to look at music in its totality, and that a general conductor needs to approach new music, and that a new music person can't act as if this music just fell from the sky, which is how it was done for a fairly long period. And there were some sociological and political reasons behind that to birth it, I guess. But as your own career arc demonstrates, that had to be changed.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Fill in a few blanks, though, on the resume between Youngstown Public Schools and Daniel Barenboim. You did go to college and you did go to graduate school.
Right. I went to undergraduate school at Florida State University in Tallahassee.
And why was that?
It was primarily because my parents had grown exhausted by the cold and the winter of Ohio, and had decided when I was in high school that they were going to move to Florida.
Rust Belt to Sun Belt.
Exactly. So I think it was just the timing of that move, along with looking at schools in the state where they were moving, that resulted in me going to Florida State. And that was an excellent, excellent place for me to go. I had a tremendously high quality education there. And then when I was playing bassoon, which was my main instrument in college, I had occasion to be playing with the Miami Orchestra. And their soloist on their first concert in the fall was an Israeli pianist, Shulamit Ran, who had moved from Tel Aviv to New York City at around age 15 or 16, and was now living permanently in the United States, concertizing as a pianist, and had a parallel career as a composer, but mainly was a pianist. And I was in the orchestra, and she came out to play with a Schumann concerto. And at the intermission, I went up to the conductor and I said, is there any chance that you could possibly invite me to meet this young lady. I'm quite taken by her in a variety of ways.
She's quite takenable.
Yeah, absolutely. And so the long story short was that we went out, we dated for a year and a half, and subsequently got married. And afterwards, she, through the kindness and generosity of her mentor, Ralph Shapey, was invited to come as assistant professor of composition at the University of Chicago. So I followed her to Chicago and proceeded to get my PhD at Northwestern while she was starting her career at the University of Chicago. Then I was hired subsequently at Northwestern on the music faculty after I completed my PhD, and did a lot with their jazz program as well as with their conducting and ensemble programs. And then Shulamit was appointed composer in residence at Chicago Symphony, and then she suggested that maybe I do some of her conduct some of her new music concerts, the ones she curated for the symphony, and then that led to an increased affiliation with Civic and new music concerts curated by Shulamit with the CSO, which then led to, when Mr. Barenboim came as music director, I was already around, and then I had access to meet him, and then we developed a professional and personal relationship, and that brings you.
And then, through. And also, Mr. Barenboim had brought Mr. Boulez to town, and that enabled
Absolutely.
An additional connection. Unless the listener worry that there's any tinge of nepotism in Cliff Colnott's career, we should say that although they've remained professional colleagues, Ms. Ron and Mr. Colnott went their own ways personally. And if you've seen Shulamit with her husband say he doesn't look like Cliff Colnott, that's because she has a different husband.
Absolutely.
But they were able to continue to work together and respect each other and support each other's work, which is also a wonderful thing. Mentor, you used the word about Ralph Shapey to Shulamit, and obviously a number of the people we've mentioned, from Shapey to Barenboim to Boulez and others, have been mentors to you. Just the very art of understanding and respecting the role of a mentor is one that I think is downplayed too much in the world, and wondering if you might reflect a bit about that. And you're at a point, too, where you've been a mentor to a number of people.
That's another excellent question. For me, the most fundamental aspect of the mentor relationship is the access. Obviously, if you don't have access to the person that you want to mentor you or that you admire and want to learn more about his or her musical and social political values, and you don't have access, then that's problematic, obviously. So these people are typically inundated with requests from people and are incredibly busy, and so there's an issue of access, and because I had access through my work with the CSO, I don't take that lightly and recognize it as an incredible privilege that I had to have access to the various people, Mr. Boulez, Mr. Barenboim, and others that come through the CSO on a regular basis. The second part of it, once access you're able to get access, is, and probably the most important part as far as I'm concerned, is curiosity. The notion that one should try to replicate the mentor's modus operandi, I think, is wrong-headed. Mm-hmm. You see that a lot. I'm sure you see it more than I do with the younger generation of 25 to 35-year-old orchestra conductors who, when you see them, you see, and I personally don't think it's a positive thing, you see, oh, well, somebody, this person has obviously studied and imitated and purposely tried to speak, look like, handle themselves like their mentor. I don't find that, my own personal opinion is that's not an optimal use of the mentor relationship and not an optimal use of the access. For me, it's more productive to be preternaturally curious. Mm-hmm. The more questions that one can ask, I think the relationship becomes more productive. And that's basically what I did with both Mr. Boulez and Mr. Barenboim, and continue to do so.
We'll come back to each of them and your relationships with them, lessons learned, and et cetera, from them. But I want to sort of give the other side of that image you've created, and that is when you're working with somebody who's come to work with you, and I had an interesting opportunity to sort of at second hand observe this a bit, because a young friend of mine from the West Eastern Divan Orchestra, who is also a budding conductor, South American but based in Switzerland, actually came over on his own dime for a week from Geneva to do some classes with you in conducting. And so he'd get up in the morning, very nervous, going over his scores, leaves. I've got to get ready for Cliff. Got to get ready for Cliff. And then in the evening, I'd say, well, what did you all do? How does Cliff do? He says, well, he asked me a lot of questions. And he showed me how to ask a lot of questions of the score. And then another friend said, well, are you waving your hands? Or he says, no, we didn't get to that. Maybe we'll get to that later. Maybe we won't get to that. But he's really showing me it's about questions. And I have to have my questions ready. And not my answers ready. I have to have my questions ready. So I think that reflects very well on what you're talking about and that you're practicing what you preach.
Absolutely.
As well.
This young man, this was an exceptional experience for me because he was so bright and so curious and imaginative, and it was an absolute privilege for me. He's going to have a real career.
Well, that's terrific to hear. When you are working with Barenboim, give us an example or some anecdote or some experience or set of experiences of something that you've worked together on with him or that you've worked to help him prepare or to help his musicians prepare for him, I guess.
As many people know, most of his music making begins and ends with sound and how he thinks about sound, how he encourages people to alter the sound based on musical context, based on harmony, et cetera, et cetera. And so for me, the years of access and the years of me asking questions were basically about that. I needed to go from basically complete ignorance. I had never thought about nor been provoked to think about sound ever in my career until I met Mr. Barenboim.
Even though you were a PhD, you were an established conductor nationally and internationally in new music repertoire, jazz arranging, etc. Sound had not come up.
No.
Why is that?
I don't find it particularly striking as I talk to other colleagues and read what other people have written and hear people speak about music. I don't think a lot of people think about.
That's what I mean. Why is it they don't think about that?
I don't know. I have no idea. It was the experience of going to school at the Barenboim Academy. And that was not something that was a 6-week learning right. learning annex kind of thing. I mean that was 2, 3, 4 years of a lot of questions and a lot of work and with him with he being very demanding. I mean it was not something that I could pretend I understood. He was very very quick to say but what do you think? So it was this exposure to the notion of sound, and then the secondary issue of how most musical decisions flow from the harmonic structure that radically changed my point of view about music, regardless whether it's pop music or jazz or the Rive Deux.
Let's hear some Barenboimian sound now.
Thank you.
The second movement, Romanza from Schumann's Symphony No. 4 in D minor, Opus 120, Daniel Barenboim leading his Staatskapelle Berlin, recorded in Berlin in 2003. Attentiveness, it sounds like, is the connector between the focus on sound per se, anatomically, philosophically, meteorologically, physically, and the understanding that, from Mr. Barenboim's perspective, harmony and harmonic structure is the motive force within music, because that requires an attentiveness that might be thrown off by rhythm, history, melody. Not that those are not important, but that for a real composer, the decisions are being made deliberately and unconsciously through harmonic development and change, and that a conductor, a performer, has to pay attention to.
Absolutely. One of the most simple, in a way, reductive, in a way, illustrations of this is when Mr. Barenboim talks about melody as ultimately depending upon harmony for its affect, or a lot of its affect. Mm-hmm. And of course, this again was completely new to me. As you think about an 8-bar, a 12-bar, 16-bar melody unfolding without any harmony, and then the harmonization of the melody imputes certain quality, mm-hmm. a certain quality to each separate pitch in terms of the tension and release and the affect and emotional component of them. It was a profound thing to have him sit down at the piano and play just a simple diatonic melody, mm-hmm. which was not that engaging, frankly, and then add just simple diatonic harmonies against, with an occasional appoggiatura, against the melody and realize that the affect of the melody, tremendous control and tremendous variability based on the harmonic implications.
I'm interested, though, that you're saying that had not occurred to you, I would think, consciously, because in jazz, so much of the way melody is treated, the idea that there's no one version of a song, there's the song and then everybody has his or her own version of it, is through harmonic change and development. So you must have had a consciousness of it. You maybe just hadn't focused on it.
It's a completely legitimate question, and my explanation for it is that since I was in high school and certainly during college and then the first 10 years or so when I was in my 20s, my primary emphasis was rhythm. For me the jazz experience, because I was very young and I wasn't that, you know, I hadn't had a lot of exposure to musical greatness. I was well trained, but you know, I wasn't surrounded by the Boulezes and the Barenboims.
Musical makingness. I mean, as I asked initially, you were a kid, starts off banging on something, whether it's the piano, the guitar, or a can, right?
Right. So for me, the jazz experience was one of basically groove, mm-hmm. you know, like Ray Brown. I was mm-hmm. fascinated with the ability of somebody to go. I was just mesmerized. Well,
it's mesmerizing.
The harmony and the melodic, the melody and the harmony and how they spoke. And I mean, I'm not saying this is something that I think was good, but it was true. I just was unaware of this.
Right.
And then I became very interested in pop music. Mm-hmm. And pop music, for those of us that are aficionados and know about the essence of pop music, is the melody sung by the singer and the snare drum backbeat.
The hook.
I mean, what producers talk about is, I want to hear a backbeat, and I want it here in the mix, and I want to hear the hook. I want to hear the singing. Mm-hmm. So again, there's a period of time, 8-9 years, in which I'm completely engaged in pop music. But that, again, is not about any mm-hmm. of the Barenboim, quote-unquote, values. It's about the backbeat and the feeling of the rhythm and the mm-hmm. and the melody. And then new music, of course, in that period of time particularly, was also, I mean, it was before Mr. Boulez's profound contribution, I mean, there are many contributions, but in my view, his most profound contribution to the music of our time, it was in its incipient stages in terms of being recognized and spoke about and imitated when I was involved in new music. New music at that time, I don't mean to say for everybody, but certainly the primary emphasis was the math.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 4, 5, 1, 2, 4, 5, 1, 2, 5, 1. And then we have on top of that, yet, dot, 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 we have fours. Okay, so now let's line those up so that the fours fit in the middle of the fives. And then we have, you know, that was what I was engaged in. I was engaged in the mathematics of new music, not what I'm engaged in now,
right,
and not what Mr. Boulez had always believed, I'm sure, but never until recently had not gotten into the mainstream, which
right,
was this confluence of the science and the art,
mm-hmm,
and with the audibility being primary thing. None of this was really spoken about that much or prioritized. It was more about, can you organize this mathematically so that the sevens and the sixes and the fives and are sounding. This is a puzzle. This is not really art.
When Mr. Barenboim was announced as the music director designate here in Chicago to succeed Sir George Schulte, soon afterwards there was a brief but big scandal that he had also been hired to head the Paris Opera, the new Bastille Opera, and he was going to be bringing in as his kind of right-hand advisor, fellow conductor Pierre Boulez. This all blew up in a lot of different directions, and the results were he didn't go to Paris, fortunately for Chicago. He did come to Chicago more full-time than he might have initially wanted to, and he brought with him Pierre Boulez, because Boulez announced he would not have anything to do with the Paris regime that was going to replace the contracted regime with Mr. Barenboim. And in interviews, including one I was able to do back when I was at the Wall Street Journal, that was 89-90, many people were very intrigued at this bond that appeared to exist between these two men who had worked together somewhat when Barenboim was pretty young, but really were not seen as soulmates by people who didn't know them well. And then as the years unfolded here in Chicago, which really was their common meeting point, if not temporally, spatially, because they often were here when the one was here when the other was away, it began to unfold in a way that, as you were talking about, discovering sound as important, harmony as important, seemed so obvious. Their personalities might appear different, or their reading habits, or their physical conducting styles, even some of their repertoire interests. But the basic focus on music as a totality and science meeting art and sound, they're almost twins there, aren't they?
I don't have anything that I could add that would enhance your articulate description.
Well, leave that aside. What you can add is
really
give us some mini version, as you did, of the Barenboim Academy, of the Boulez Academy for us.
The various lessons learned from Mr. Boulez had to do primarily with three areas. The first one was what he would call hygiene, musical hygiene.
Hmm.
He's an incredibly funny man, as you know, has a tremendous sense of humor and an uber mensch, in my opinion. I mean, just in terms of the way he treats human beings and the way he carries himself and how
Coleman.
He interacts with musicians. It's just, to me, it's awe-inspiring. And with that sense of humor, often his pithy remark to me would be at Lucerne or in Chicago for Music Now or other groups that we would be working together on. He would say, Cliff, I would say, Maestro, what would you like me to do specifically today on Derive or on whatever work we're doing? He would say, hygiene.
Cliff, hygiene.
Yeah. And at first I didn't, I mean, at first I was.
You thought, do I need to take a shower?
I didn't understand. Comb my hairs. And then he would say, you know, just work on the cleaning up of the music so that and still that didn't quite get to the essence of what he really was saying, which I only understood a little bit later, which then brings me to the thing that I think is most valuable, and the thing that I learned from him that is most valuable is the question of audibility. Mm-hmm. We choose tempi based on not what the metronome marking is, nor on what performance practice has told us through recordings or word of mouth, but we choose those may in fact be the same. But the primary criterion is audibility. We don't play it too fast if we can't hear the musical material mm-hmm. with tremendous clarity. We don't do it too slow if the musical material is distorted and pulled in a way that it's not audible and doesn't have integrity. Well, that sounds, of course, to someone who's not thoughtful as somewhat reductive and almost silly. It's like, well, yeah, I mean, music's about sound. We have to hear audibility. It's like, but very, very complex issues of timbre, vibrato, balancing very thick textures in a way that in which there are not just two layers, you know, the Hauptstimme and then the second voices of five, six, seven different layers that all have to be treated and dealt with in a very sense. And that's, you know, he's just a master at that. It's not a mystery to me why there are multiple Grammys and that kind of international acclaim over decades. It's that some people, you know, there'll be people who are not thoughtful, in my opinion, who are not paying attention, who see somebody conduct without a baton, somebody who conducts fairly discompassionately, not extroverted, not someone who is might be said as not inspirational in terms of the lack of physical moving and involvement with the. But that begs the question, how does this man win Grammy after Grammy after? It's not politics. He's a French man. It's not, it's not
and
politics.
He certainly doesn't get involved in any politics.
And have a career of decades and decades of veneration. How does that happen?
Yeah.
And then, of course, then if someone's thoughtful again, they say, oh, well, yeah. Okay, but start with the fact that he can take any score and in a matter of 10 minutes have it just completely audible. Just know exact, and this is not something that very many people can do.
You said there were three areas, and we're using the buzzwords or the single word summations: hygiene, audibility,
and the third is the absolute insistence that the music of our time be treated with the same respect and care that we've treated the Eroica and the Jupiter Symphony and Mahler and Bruckner and others.
And that goes back to Schoenberg's reminding us, my music isn't modern, it's not even difficult, it's just poorly played.
Precisely. Oh,
I've paraphrased a bit. But if a work can be given that care, then it will stand or fall on its merit.
Correct.
And not on prejudice and not
Precisely.
On lack of understanding.
And so that last bit of wisdom is what I think currently informs my effectiveness to the extent that somebody might think I'm effective with new music. It's directly related to that T-shirt, which is mm-hmm. you go into the rehearsal and, okay, so the fives are rushing, so you really can't hear. It's not really balanced. It's a little out of tune. The chord is not – it's like unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, folks.
Mm-hmm.
And then what ends up happening at the end is that there's an ownership around the music on the part of the players who see it differently than just being something noisy and not incoherent. And that's Mr. Boulez.
I think your opinion is the right opinion here. Let's hear from Mr. Pierre Boulez.
Thank you.
The 1976-1977 Messages Keys for solo cello and six additional cellos by Pierre Boulez. They're in a recording from 1999 with Jean-Guillain Queyras, who was then the cello member of the Ensemble Intercontemporain, and six fellow Parisian cellists. This has wound up being the first part of a two-part conversation with Cliff Colnott of so many places, but for the purposes of this week's program, Director of Orchestral Activities at DePaul University, and Wednesday, May 30th, he'll be leading the annual free concert of the DePaul University Symphony Orchestra with another cellist, a very fine cellist, Stephen Balderston, as soloist in Tchaikovsky's Rococo Variations, Other Music of Tchaikovsky, and the Bartok Concerto for Orchestra. We want to thank Matt DeStefano for recording and producing this program and making it sound great. We want to thank Fran Huscher for nudging us to make sure that we did this. And thank you, Fran, always for your very well-placed and intended nudges. We want to thank our funders, Alphawood Foundation and Draupner LLC, a Chicago-based private equity firm, as well as other friends of this program. You can hear the discussion from this program online at WFMT.com, thanks to Matt DeStefano as well. Let us know what you think of this or any of our other programs. Drop us a line at RENTAP, that's Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P at AOL.com. I'm Andrew Patner, your host and producer for this series. We'll see you next week.